Ali Hopper, the co-founder of Guards Against Trafficking, has walked the cartel-controlled trails. She has seen the torn clothing of children assaulted, the passport of a five-year-old girl who vanished without a trace, and into the hands of traffickers, one of many missing children. Now, she's uncovered policy failures, confronted ruthless cartels feeding a child trafficking crisis at our border, and even exposing an underground trade in human organs. She's joining me to tell us what is really happening in the shadows.
They want justice. They want answers.
It stands out to you about his personality.
What's the family want most of all?
Closure.
But you were just the last person to see her.
Get out
there's
of my
an
yard
arrest warrant.
And leave.
You have a lot of weighty accusations.
Ali, I think you're in one of those industries where it weighs so heavy on the heart. I'm curious to know, before we get into all the revelations and all the information you've revealed, not only to legislators, but just to the public, what did you want to be growing up, and how did you end up taking this journey fighting for human rights?
That's a great question. Thank you so much for having me on. I always wanted to fight for justice, whether it be for children, whether it be justice in the justice system. I grew up wanting to be an attorney. My father is an attorney. And so that is what I saw myself doing growing up, was advocating for justice. And so that is how I found myself operating and fighting for justice, just in a different way.
When you were stationed at the border, how did that opportunity come about? And what were you told, and then what did you quickly learn about human trafficking?
So it was an interesting story leading up to the first trip to the border. I had introduced anti-grooming legislation in Florida, and when I was going through that process, I had met my now business partner, Dr. Jared Sadolsky. I had met him at an event, and I knew he had prior law enforcement experience. And so I wanted to get his insights on the language itself, making sure that it was robust and had teeth and was able to accomplish what we were trying to accomplish by protecting children from adults sexually grooming them. And so, you know, after a couple months, we got the legislation passed, and him and I reconnected, and I found out more about what he did to combat human trafficking. And I was just in awe of what he was doing, and he was doing it all on his own. And I said, how can I help? What can I do? And that's really where it started, was that willingness to help and assist in any way possible, not for any monetary gain or any notoriety or, you know, recognition on media or anywhere else, but really just to get to the bottom of combating human trafficking and protecting children. And so that led to our first trip to the border, not his first, but mine. And this was under the past administration. So the border looks much differently now than it did then.
Yeah,
and at the time that we had gone to the border was very insecure. It was not secured in any way, shape, or form. Border Patrol was present, but they were held back from doing their job in a meaningful way. And so we saw open borders. We saw people flooding in. We saw children. We saw just the paths littered with identifications and passports. And that was really my first introduction into what the open borders was doing to our country, what it was doing to the migrants crossing into our country, the terrors that they faced along the way, and how cartels and gang members exploited the open borders for their monetary gain. And it was a really important, experience to have, because I got a lot in a short amount of time working there, seeing people crossing in firsthand in front of me, and seeing the way that they looked, how exhausted they were, and the journeys that they took. So it was really important to get that understanding, not just what the media was not talking about, but basically what the American public knew nothing about at that time. And so understanding what the experiences were of the migrants that were crossing in and walking the pathways that they walked, we saw exploitation, signs of exploitation littered everywhere. And, you know, I'll spare your audience the gory details, but it is exactly what the cartels had set it up to be. They set it up to be a trail of terror, almost, to scare these illegal immigrants into submission to make sure that they are doing what the cartels and gangs want them to do. And so many of these families, men, women, and children, were exploited all along the way into the country and beyond.
Now, paint a picture. Are these unsuspecting children and families getting approached at the border beforehand? When did the cartels get access? And also, side note, I'm assuming border officials know of this. They know of these operations. Is it that their hands were tied politically? Or tell me about that dynamic.
So those are two very good questions, and I would love to get to both of them. So I'll get to your first one first. The experiences that these illegal immigrants faced were different in every country and in every circumstance. So the cartels knew that they could exploit these open borders. They knew the pathways and the trails in which to exploit. So some of the illegal immigrants were looking for a better life. Some were told, hey, we can bring you to this better life. You're guaranteed to get in. You're guaranteed to get a cell phone and a paycheck and housing. And so some of them were actually given false promises and a false illusion as to what that trip, what that journey would look like. And we would get asked many times, what kind of parent would let their child make this journey alone? Well, some of them didn't know what their children were going to experience. And the ones that did, I think they were in such a place of hopelessness that they figured that this was their child's best chance at survival. But the ones that didn't know, they would have smugglers come up to their door and say, I can bring your child to America. Let me know what you want, where you want them to go, where you want them to end up, what sponsor you want listed. And so they were almost tricked into a false impression and led to believe what this journey would look like. And many of those parents never saw their children again, never heard from their children again. And so when these smugglers would go up to these parents, they would portray themselves in a way that's saying, look, all these other parents are letting these children go with us because they trust us enough. They know that we can get their children there to a better life. So trust us. And it was that snake oil salesman in many cases. Many cases, there were language barriers. It's a third world country in some of these countries that were coming here. And so the circumstances look different in every situation that we've encountered. Some of them, I mean, they were aware of what could potentially happen, but I don't think that they really thought it would happen to them. And then that trail through the Darien Gap, almost everyone was exploited if they even were able to survive that trip.
And you were going to circle back to the politics of it all. It wasn't as though it was seen and ignored, or was it? I mean, what were the political dynamics, and or is it a shortage of officers at the border? I mean, has there ever been a force to conquer the cartels and the trafficking?
Yeah, it's a couple of things. It was the fact that the border wall was unfinished in many places. It was very old in other places and in dire need of repair. And the Border Patrol agents were very understaffed. The morale was very low. Even if they did intervene, it was a catch and release type system. So their efforts were, they felt, for nothing, because if they did their jobs, it was just going to be undone by releasing that illegal immigrant into the country. And so morale coupled with, you know, just this flood of individuals at the border. And when you imagine it, it's just thousands pouring in, and there's not nearly enough Border Patrol agents to do anything, and an administration that did not support the rule of law, did not support our immigration system, did not support border security, national security, or even our men and women in uniform. And so it was all of those things wrapped into one, and now this administration has the overwhelming task of undoing what the past administration did.
And I think mass amount of people, they think about border crossing and immigration their mind doesn't go to the shadows and the darker ends of it, the sex trafficking, the human trafficking that we're going to detail. What does the operation standpoint look like? What's the purpose? Is there a sale at the other end? Where do they end up, those who are a victim? Is it human trafficking for labor, slavery in a sense? Is it sex trafficking specifically? What did you see?
So a lot of it would depend on the territory in which they were crossing over, the cartels and gangs that they would interact with. As we know that there were crossings in California, Arizona, Texas, and so each one of those have different cartels and gangs that operate in those areas in Mexico. And so it really depended on the cartels and gangs that they dealt with, that they interacted with, the smugglers that were looped in with those cartels and gangs. And so every experience, again, was different. But what you would see or what you could expect is that you would partner with a smuggler. They would give you a price to cross into the border. Now, depending on the smuggler's integrity, and I use that term loosely, is whether or not that smuggler would continue to add on charges to the debt that you owed. Many times it would be a hard line in the sand, let's say $15,000, this is what was expected, this is what was paid, that was what was agreed upon, and that was what was delivered. And so that was a rare occasion, though. Many smugglers would deliver an amount or say that this was the amount, and then as time went on, as time progressed, you could see interest rates or crossing for through this terrain added this much to the bill, or the weather added this much on to the tab, and you asked for a bottle of water or your daughter needed, you know, a snack, well, we're going to charge you $15 for that snack. And so they start incurring charges and fees on top of the fact that having these smugglers, some of them were actually embedded in these groups by cartel members to determine which ones could pay and which ones couldn't pay. And so they would prey on the ones that they determined could not pay. And so then they would know that once they got to their end destination, that these were the people that were going to be in debt to the cartel, and that these were the people that were going to pay off that debt, whether at risk to themselves, the family they traveled with, or their family back home. That was how they gained control over these people, along with just the sheer fear of going against a cartel member. So they started accumulating this debt. And then as soon as they get into the country, they are tasked and required to pay off that debt. And depending on how sophisticated the cartel is that they're dealing with, some of these cartel members actually keep this data of debts owed in databases in the cloud, so that anyone can access in their organization who owes what, and keep these debts, you know, monitored and accounted for, and make sure that they're paying down their debts. But it really becomes a very sad cycle, because as they're working to pay off their debt, whether it be through sex trafficking or labor trafficking, they're still incurring more charges. As they're living in these places, they're being charged rent, they're being charged food, they're being charged utilities. And so it becomes a cycle that is nearly impossible to get out of. Some have gotten out of it, but it's taken blood, sweat, tears, and parts of their soul before the very few have been able to actually pay down the debt and get free of the cartel.
I mean, it's entrapment from the very beginning for some of these people. There's a statistic, I think it was over 324,000 unaccounted for children. Do you surmise that is sex trafficking?
It could be any of the above. Many of the unaccompanied children that have now been accounted for, they were found in sex trafficking situations, they were found in labor trafficking situations, or they were found in houses or homes with known pedophiles, known gang members, known criminals with rap sheets that would wrap around, you know, the street. And so whether it be through sex trafficking or labor trafficking or drug packaging or working the corner to sell drugs as a drug courier, drug dealer, that is what they were tasked with. And often many of the kids were unable to survive, or they've been moved around since to continue to work to pay off that debt.
What is the youngest child that you saw fall victim to human trafficking?
So one of the children that we saw, that we encountered, she was five. One of these situations that my business partner and I encountered was in a shelter in McAllen, Texas, and it was an influx facility. And in the facility, this mother was holding on to her child. All the other children in the facility were playing together. She would not put down this child. And when she was asked, you know, why won't you put this child down so that the child can go play with the other children? She said, because along the journey, she was traveling with three children. Her other two children had been taken to pay off the debt that she owed to the cartel. So what we've personally seen is as young as five, but we know that it's anywhere from 2, 5, all the way up to 17 years old.
And what about the recovery process? Is there an operation set up to try and recover these missing children? And a lot of people would wonder, you know, do you ever find them? Do they just vanish for all of time? Are some found? Is there a percentage that are recovered? Or is there not a task force or an agency set up for that?
Yeah, this administration has taken this issue, this matter, very seriously. They have tasked numerous federal agencies to locate and find these children and make sure that they are in safe situations or living circumstances. And if they aren't, they are recovered and brought into safer circumstances to ensure that. But I would say out of the 320,000 that have been deemed unaccounted for, and that number fluctuates, they had last reported 13,000 that were now accounted for. That is out of 320,000 unaccounted for. And would you,
would you happen to know if that was labor or sex trafficking? Which one? Was there a breakdown from the recovered, from the intel received?
Not sure. They haven't given that breakdown yet. I think that a lot of it stems from dealing with being able to determine the circumstances in which they were recovered from, and if there's going to be criminal charges or deportations that lead to that afterwards. But the first priority is the recovering of those unaccounted for children, or at least accounting for them. Some of them may be fine, but they have since moved from the last known location. And so this administration is really just trying to determine where they are, keep an accurate accounting of their location, who their sponsor is, and validate that that sponsor is in fact fits one of the categories that they should fit for sponsoring a child, and make sure that that child is safe and going to school. We had spoken to an individual in the Midwest that had said, we weren't sure how to handle this because the child labor laws here in Texas, we see some of these unaccompanied children come in, they're exhausted, they're dirty, they're tired, they're hungry. And she said, we know that they're working outside of school, but we don't know what to do. And first and foremost, it's really important to know that if they join the unaccompanied children program, under no circumstances are they to be working. So already on its face, that was already a breach of the agreement for unaccompanied children, that they are not to be working, they are to be fed, they are to have a roof over their head, clothes on their body, and to be attending school. And so these are the factors that were unable to be followed up with because the past administration had kept the database of this information so close to the vest that they weren't even sharing the locations of these children and where their sponsors were with state agencies. So in July of 2024, my business partner had testified in front of a Senator Grassley's roundtable, and they next to him was Director Siobhan Harris, and she's the DCF director in Florida. And she was relaying to Senator Grassley that she had been begging and pleading with HHS and ORR, Office of Refugee Resettlement, to give her access to the data of the children that were sent to Florida so they could do welfare checks. And they were not able to get access to that information. They were stonewalled.
Is that a political issue? Why would anyone block that information, a welfare check of children?
Well, as far as the Office of Refugee Resettlement, that falls under, you know, federal management. And so at that time, that was under the past administration. And we ask the very same questions that you ask. Why would you not release that information? If your accounting of where these children are can lead to states now taking responsibility and accountability for the welfare checks needing to be done to ensure the welfare and the well-being of these children, then why wouldn't you hand over that information? It's all questions that we've asked, and it's all questions that have yet to get answered because there's silence from the past administration on why they did what they did and why was it acceptable.
There's an interesting stat. You found that there was a price tag essentially on certain young children or I don't know if there's an age requirement, age range for this, but it was 5,000 and then 15,000 to 20,000 for a special request. Decipher those. What would a special request be? And what happens to these kids when you put those dollar amounts on them?
So special requests, what we've seen in our line of work, usually entail either a really young child or it entails things tied to factors like, is the child a virgin? Is the child tested as STD-free? Is the child healthy? Depending on their preference, both boys and girls were included in these requests, and we did see requests for children as young as 6 months old.
And that is specifically for sex trafficking?
Correct.
And sidebar, I was a correspondent in Las Vegas, and I remember one of the most horrific stories that I've ever covered. It was in Pahrump, and it was a man who was captured filming himself on videotape, so police had the evidence. And I'll never forget the press conference where the sheriff broke down in tears, and he was abusing, it was a six-month-old, and it was so traumatic to even think that this exists, that these people exist, and then the predator filmed it on top of that. And it is such a dark area of the world, but it's important to talk about because, as you just mentioned, politics plays such a huge role. And I think a community doesn't know what to do about it. And I feel like many people out there have been in a situation where they look at a girl and they think, are they okay? I'm not sure. You know, and when it comes to that, is it identifiable in public, would you say, from day-to-day lives? Could you spot a victim, or who is most susceptible in this situation from the border to beyond? Because I think this is an issue internationally. You're hearing a lot about other countries such as Dubai preying on influencers and young models. I'll give you a lump sum, $15,000 to get on the plane. You'll stay here. You'll do this. Maybe you'll shoot a video or do a photo shoot. All entrapment. You know, is the face of it changing? Is it modernizing? I know these are a bunch of questions, but just give me the overall landscape of how serious the sex trafficking is from the border and beyond.
So, lots of great questions. Where I would start is the border being open and under the past administration was one problem. It exacerbated a problem that already existed. So the American public needs to be aware that sex trafficking, human trafficking, labor trafficking has been present, was present prior to the border being open. Now, the border being opened exacerbated that issue. It added gasoline to a fire that was already there and created much more of a demand. But I do want to make a very clear point that the cartel would not be as adamant about bringing people here to fill roles of sex trafficking and labor trafficking if there wasn't a demand here. So the American public needs to understand that the demand for the commodity that these cartels are bringing, and I hate saying that, you know, human beings are a commodity, but that is how they are looked at in this industry, is as a commodity. And so we need to understand that the cartels would not be bringing men, women, children here to fill sex trafficking, you know, roles or labor trafficking positions if there wasn't a demand for it. So the American people really need to look at the morality around the subject, their willingness to do something about it, their willingness to reach out to their local communities and start to talk about it, because it is a horrible subject. We have talked with numerous people at the local level and at the state level, and some of it is just so hard to digest. It's so hard to hear, but putting your head in the sand on it isn't going to make it stop. It's not going to make this modern day slavery around you stop. It just inhibits your willingness or your ability to do something about it. And so we wonder how all of these tragedies have happened throughout history. And we look back and we say, well, why didn't they do anything during World War II and the Holocaust? Why didn't they do anything during slavery in America that led to the Civil War? Why didn't they do anything? But we look now and we see society acting much in a very similar way, where it's just too hard to hear. I'm too busy. You know, I have my family to take care of. That is a priority, to take care of your family. But in the meantime, there are certain evils in the world that cannot be ignored, and they cannot be allowed to continue to exist. So we really need to look into the morality, that it's a heart issue, that the American public is just as complicit in this crime by driving that demand, or by not combating it in an active way and being inactive in the fight against human trafficking. But what I want to say is that parents really need to be aware, because the border was one issue. But again, like I said, this human trafficking matter has been going on for a very long time, and the internet only exacerbated the issue. You have predators now that don't even have to leave the comforts of their own home. They are behind a computer. You are, as a parent, are none the wiser that as your child is on their phone and scrolling through these apps and on Snapchat and on Roblox and on Discord and playing video games, that these predators are lurking in the shadows of your own living room.
And I think, circling back to being proactive as an individual and of within community, I do think a lot of people think about huge issues and think, well, I'm just a drop in the bucket. I'm just an individual. How can I make an impact? How can little old me in the city of Santa Monica or Pasadena or Iowa make an impact to this magnitude? But then you also see the power of, again, going back to civil rights. When everyone rallies, the advocacy groups, the agencies, you don't want to rely on them, but you see the turnout when people really come together and say, this is wrong. This needs to stop. And it's just chilling to see the demand that people have, the predators. And I also think it's hard to wrap your head around the amount of predators in our society, that they walk among us. They work with us. They're in front of us at the grocery store. And I think it's one of those things where do I start? Where do I begin? You were in a unique position where you were talking face-to-face with these human traffickers, sex traffickers. What's the profile of these people? What do they say? What's the moral compass on why they do what they do? And do they talk about, is that how you discovered the need for it, is through talking and engaging with the human traffickers?
Yeah, so a lot of the human traffickers that we have specifically discussed or had conversations with were mainly from the cartel operations side. So it's not necessarily the human traffickers that are operating within the United States or that are United States citizens. But they did deliver very insightful information as to how they target their victims, how they target operations, how they now utilize the internet, they utilize AI, they utilize the online space and the online world to start to groom their victims. And so really, when they start to dissect what that looks like, it becomes very interesting, but it's also very simple. If you take Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's that pyramid, right, that starts at the bottom with the basic needs of being food, water, shelter. And then from there, you go up to more needs that lead to more psychological, mental needs, feeling part of a community. And that is where they can easily target people that need food, that need water, that need shelter. But then when you start to go to those higher levels of teenagers, of children, or men and women that are looking for companionship, looking for friendship, they target those individuals as well because they are able to fill a need or void that these people are looking for, and then they gain that through a pattern of communication and conduct. They're able to gain and manipulate and gain control of that individual. And the individual is often none the wiser, but it's easier for them to start that process with a child or a teenager. And so often that is how it goes. But how they, I guess, justify it in their mind is that, well, one of the conversations was around organ harvesting. And we were talking with this trafficker about organ harvesting. How are you able to justify? How are you able in your mind to just be okay with what you do? And so he broke it down saying, well, you take a child walking down the street. The child's alone. And obviously their parent doesn't care about them because their child is walking alone. And so if I don't grab them and if I don't profit from them, the next person that sees them walking down the street is going to grab them and profit from them. And I need to be able to support my family. And so that is how they justify it. They justify it by removing that human component of what they see as the victim as a way to be able to provide
for their family, strictly monetizing just this selfish, you know, embedded gains, looking at human beings as their gain, their opportunity. Oh gosh, that's chilling.
Yeah. And it's horrible, but that is how they justify it. That is how they look at it. That is how they're able to kind of take people outside of a human role and make them into a commodity and desensitize themselves to the fact that they're looking back at a human being.
So what was the most helpful and new revelation talking to these individuals who prey on people? What was revealed? How did you, I'm assuming you took a lot of that information, were able to take it to legislators as well. Was there any moment where you thought we can put a thumb on this? We can get a handle on this. You know, this is what we have to do. Was there operational insight, or was it just, the inner workings on how and why they do what they do?
It started out with a lot of the inner workings, trying to understand what they do, why they do it, how they do it, how do they sleep at night, basically, and start to kind of get in that criminology mentality of understanding the perpetrators themselves and then trying to understand the victims themselves. But really the hardest part about all of this is trying to understand the buyers. So from the trafficker perspective, they justify it as, okay, well, I need to make money and put food on the table. But from the buyer's perspective, and that doesn't make what they're doing okay, but from the buyer's perspective, we have yet to come across a buyer, a John or a Jane, that was able to justify it in a way saying, well, I need to put food on the table. No, you're buying something, you're spending money, and you're utilizing this individual or this opportunity as a commodity to further your needs. And how you justify that, I'm not sure. But the way that we are trying to combat this is by penalty enhancement. Because right now the penalties are very strong on the girls or boys that get caught for prostitution. But they're very weak when it comes to the individuals that are actually driving the demand. And so if you can pinch off the demand, you know, the cartels and gangs, the traffickers, are not going to find it as lucrative of a business.
But why is that? I mean, just from common sense, why, even if when it involves a minor, why is that? Is it individual states to blame for that? Or is it a federal issue?
It's all of it. I think we need to relook at our laws and how they stand federally, how they stand locally and statewide. We tried to pass some legislation here in Florida as far as the purchase of prostitution, not attacking the individual that would be charged with prostitution themselves, but the person that was purchasing prostitution, and make it a penalty enhancement to where it was no longer a misdemeanor, but a felony 3 or a felony 4. And that got rejected. And so we're really trying to dig into why. Why is the penalty so loose for those that drive the demand in this industry? And we've come up blank on it.
It's and disturbing. So I think
these are conversations the American public needs to have. We need to start understanding, you know, why? Because if you're asking the questions, Melissa, and I'm asking the questions, we're two drops in the bucket, but we need a full bucket, you know, to ask questions. And this is the thing that when you mentioned, well, what can I do as a person? Start asking these questions. Learn about this problem. Learn how to protect your family. But start asking these questions and start asking your elected officials, why are things the way they are? And even once we change legislation, why are prosecutors not prosecuting some of these cases to the fullest extent? Why are certain plea deals being given out to where it's a slap on the wrist and letting them back on the street with probation?
Well, and I think so we're really seeing it in the news more and more. I mean, going back to the P. Diddy trial, the Jeffrey Epstein, maybe it's a conversation about, you know, quote, willingness. But when you have undeniable evidence that the victim is a child, is a minor, why wouldn't that person be locked up for life? What are we missing here? You know, and maybe if it's an adult woman, I'm not condoning it in any way, but maybe people are confused on the blurred lines of defining willingness. And we're seeing this in these high profile trials, you know, and I think the public is confused by it as well. But with children, legislation should make an example, and it should be this federal legislation, I think, to make a point that this is, our children are sacred and they need to be protected.
And those are great questions. So in order for trafficking to be charged, there has to be like a force fraud or coercement, you know, element that exists, but that does not need to exist when it comes to a child. However, the way that once these things start to go to trial, we already see grown adults, men and women, that are terrified to go to trial. They're terrified to face their trafficker. They're terrified to be questioned and cross-examined. They're terrified during defense depositions because those are very intense processes. And then when you apply all of that to a child that has been traumatized, put through some of the worst experiences, and then expose them to defense depositions, expose them to being having to stand trial. And if they are afraid for their immigration status, if they're not aware that there's certain protections in place, like that they can explore a U visa or a T visa, T visa being like a visa specifically for trafficking victims. And if they're not aware of these things, you have a terrified minor that is having to face the justice system and that feels alone. And there's not many men and women that can do that in and of itself. It's rare to see bravery up on the stage of these victims to be able to face their traffickers or their offenders. And then when you put all of that weight on a child, it just makes it that much harder to get a conviction. So we really have to look at, how can we ensure justice for these children, but not re-traumatizing them in every single way along the way?
Right. Tell me about the stash houses. What is that?
So stash houses operate in a series of three. The first house is the intake process. They mark down the name, you know, country of origin, all of the outlining factors and details about who this individual is, and create a file on that person. And then oftentimes this is where major exploitation occurs initially to gain control over that victim physically, emotionally, psychologically. Then they're sent to the next stash house. And the stash house, that stash house is no longer on the border. That can be in your community. That can be in my community. That can be anywhere in any one of our 50 states. And that stash house is where they start to work and pay off that debt. That is where they will stay and reside until that debt is paid off. And then the third stash house is once they pay off that debt, then they are given their belongings back. They are treated with dignity, and then they're basically sent on their way.
Some of them escape, some of them are released, and then some of the victims are, do you think they age out, or there's just, are any of them entrapped for life, or is there a way to put it in a tier level, or is it just depending on the captors or the gang affiliated, if that makes sense?
A lot of it stems down to, unfortunately, their sheer will to live. When you're exposed to that amount of trauma, not many victims are able to survive that level of trauma, not just physically on their body, but their mental and psychological mindset. And so many of these victims don't survive. I think the lifespan of a sex trafficking victim is around 7 years. And so depending on the age of these children, a lot of that varies. A lot of it varies upon, you know, how often do they end up, if they're female, do they end up pregnant? And then most of the time those are forced abortions. So again, that's not going through probably a very sterile abortion process. And then a lot of them end up with STDs, or they end up, succumbing to illness because of weakness, dehydration. And so it's very rare that people are able to survive this level of trauma and be able to get out on the other side of it.
How have you seen it change with the new administration and the aggressive approach along the border? How is it? Have you gotten updated reports on how it's directly impacted what you do and what you've seen?
Yeah, the border is more secure than we have seen in a very, very long time. Border Patrol is hiring like crazy. Morale is up. They feel empowered and supported to be able to do their jobs. Cartel members note this. And so what they're trying to do is not only kind of fine-tune strategic operations, either through the digital opportunities or the individuals that are already inside the interior of the country, but we've heard that they are also waiting for Trump to be out, that they are counting on the next administration to resume
the cartels.
Yes. Yep. The cartels are relying on the fact that once Trump's term is over, that they will be able to resume business as usual.
Something you also discovered along the way, it's this organ trafficking. It's hard to wrap your head around. When did you first get wind of these kind of operations? And I think the first question would be, going back to sex traffickers, there has to be a demand here in the U.S. There has to be. And to want to desperately receive an organ, any means possible, it must be going to some kind of credible or operating facility to give it to someone waiting on the other end. How does that whole operation break down?
So it has been a challenge because, again, it's been operating for a very long time under the shadows, but it hasn't been as thoroughly investigated as it needs to be. But what we would say is what we learned from the trafficker that we interviewed. His family deals in organ harvesting and organ trafficking. Obviously, they know that there needs to be, depending on the organ, a blood match. There needs to be a tissue type match. And generally, some of the people that are requesting want people in better health or younger, more juvenile organs. And so what you had mentioned with sex trafficking and labor trafficking are want-based commodities. But an organ is a need-based. That is something where either the person is afraid that they're not going to make it through the next year, or their family member, loved one, child is on the registry and they have 2-3 years to wait, but only 6 months left to live. And so a lot of these bad actors in the shadows are preying on that desperation, preying on that hopelessness. So what we've seen is that the cartel will target homeless encampments, they'll target children, they will target anyone that they can easily kind of snatch up, especially in countries that have looser laws around criminality. And they also target people in vacation areas. Those individuals that are on vacation are more transient in nature, and it's a lot easier to snatch someone that's not aware of their surroundings or sometimes able to even speak the language. So what usually happens is that they are taken to places like basements of hospitals in Mexico or veterinary clinics because the investigations that I guess the government would do of a veterinary clinic is a lot lower threshold than what they would do, the inspections that they would do at a hospital. And so they'll take them to veterinary clinics. The veterinary clinics have doctors, vets, veterinarians that are able to extract organs, and they don't necessarily do it because they want to. They either do it because they are incentivized through profit, or they are forced to in fear of their life or their family's life again. So the extraction process, obviously the doctor knows. The implantation process, where the doctor receives the organ, they may or may not know where that organ came from. And so where we are trying to really dial in is when that organ is ascertained, how does it get from the criminal organization into delivering a notice in the organ database that an organ has become available? And typically how that happens is they say, oh, this individual in our country died in a car accident, so we have these organs available with this blood type, tissue type, you know, stuff like that. And so there is more of an immediate rush to get those organs and be able to provide them to those in need. And often it is U.S. buyers. Sometimes you'll find U.S. buyers that go to Central America, Mexico, for some of these procedures. They have medical tourism in these areas because they think that the regulations are a lot less, it's cheaper, you know, the doctors are just as talented, so I can get my procedure done with a fraction of the price. But they're not aware that some of these more nefarious activities exist in the background.
When it comes to the receiver or the doctor, or is there a world where one agency involved does not know the means of transport or how, where that organ came from? Is it split? I mean, I'm sure there's this underground network where, I mean, there's a black market for everything, right? I'm sure there's an underground network where everyone's in the know. But when it comes to certain U.S. affiliated agencies or receivers, is there a world where one end is unaware, or they just don't want to know and they don't ask the questions?
Absolutely. So like you said, there is a black market for organs, but there is also that other side where somehow along the way, they're able to almost like launder the how they obtained that organ, and be able to kind of shed where that organ was obtained from and be able to give it to a legitimate organ procurement agency and get it to a doctor. So at some point, and that's where we need to dig in more societally and from the federal level, local level, and start to understand how that process works by digging into the organ procurement process and figuring out how is it that they, if they receive organs from a different country, what does that look like? What are the steps that are being taken? But obviously these are things that a organ harvester, organ trafficker is not going to know. So we ourselves need to kind of do that due diligence And in the shadows, because obviously you're going to disrupt operations, which can present a very dangerous circumstance.
Are there any stats on how prevalent this is, or is that something that's still difficult to really put a percentage or a number on?
It is difficult at this time. We have been able to find numbers and what each organ is valued at. But as far as how prevalent this is, especially when you're not dealing more with the black market or procedures that are going on, implantation procedures where the doctor implanting the organ knows it's harvested, but more of the above board procedures, it really is hard to gauge that. But it is going to require people, citizens with those skill sets to start digging into contracts, to start digging into the chain of custody of an organ and really understand how that happens. How is it if you're receiving an organ from a different country, how that works, and really start to understand that, because it is an industry that solely relies on people's desperation and knowing that the organ donor list is very long.
When it comes to the victims who are snatched, is there any data on if they're released? Are they stitched up and set free? Are they actually killed for this? Is there any information that you've received on that end?
I would say that from our research, it depends on the health of the individual that they are snatching. So if the individual appears in not so great health, what they will do is they'll just take the kidney. But if they are in need or they just want payment for the entire individual, they will take as many organs as is needed. And I'm sorry if this is a little gruesome for your audience, but, you know, that includes the blood, that includes the eyes, that includes the skin. I mean, those are all organs, and people wouldn't even think of skin being an organ. But when you're a burn victim and you're needing, you know, skin, or you're in need of blood, every single organ is utilized, sold. And then we heard from the trafficker that said, yeah, we used to dispose of the bodies in one way, but now we put them in barrels, or we used to put them in barrels of acid, but now we put them in barrels of a accelerant and diesel fuel, because it disintegrates the bones. And so that is the type of individual that we're dealing with. These are the types of evils in the world that we are dealing with, and we need to be aware of that.
When you take this information, what you just said, to legislators, are they receiving it? Is it actionable information? What happens at that level?
So in my first hearing, I had mentioned that when I testified there, I had mentioned briefly the subject of organ harvesting. And that was one of the first times, to mine and my business partner's knowledge, that had been mentioned in an open hearing. Generally, they don't like to hear about that stuff. But it is something that, as we learn more about it, as we're able to get, you know, receipts, contracts, transactions, and give actionable data either to law enforcement at the local, state, or federal level, and then include lawmakers at all of those levels, I think that'll drive the conversation a lot faster. But what I think they need to see is they need to see law enforcement and lawmakers partnering together to combat this issue.
When it comes to the prey, is it immigrants coming to the U.S., feeding the U.S. market and demand for it? Are they U.S. citizens as well? Is there any breakdown information that you have pertaining to that? Is it whoever is a prey is a prey?
Good question. So when we were discussing with that organ harvester, he had said that children were a very sought after commodity. They're seen as their organs are a lot younger, healthier. And so they do prey on children. There is a market that does demand American children. because they see American children as being in healthier shape, that they have healthier organs, less diseases. And so there is a market that will ask or request for organs only from an American donor. And it's really sad because when you take these circumstances, these situations where children end up in the foster care system or they end up in situations where they're very vulnerable, we deem them runaways. They end up, you know, with horrible CPS circumstances. Those are the children that are generally preyed upon, are the ones that run away, they trust the wrong person, and then they are no longer sought after by law enforcement, and then they disappear.
I mean, huge missing children database. I mean, just the missing persons and just unsolved cases by the hundreds of thousands. So when you hear about information like this operating, you have to think, you know, is that a is it gang oriented on the U.S. side? Is it more organized? Is it, you know, at a higher level of operation? Is it people in the medical field? Any information on that regard?
So as far as outside of the U.S., that's more of where our information comes from. Again, it does involve people in the medical field, but it's usually by a force, fraud, or coercion to force these doctors to comply. We had traveled to a country in South America to protect the identity of the individual I'm speaking about, and one of the police sergeants came up to us and said, you know, we didn't really think we had an organ harvesting problem here, but we had a doctor that came to us and said that he was being forced into extracting organs, and he was really terrified. And so the national police were working really hard to ensure the protection of this doctor that had come forward to blow the whistle, and the doctor ended up murdered. And so it is such a dark and dangerous industry, and it's one of the ones that is the most profitable because it's need-based, not want-based, that a lot of people, if they are aware of any operations, they're too afraid to come forward.
What can everyday people do? And how do you continue with your agency to do what you do? Because you had mentioned legislators, they want receipts, they want as much information as possible to make it easier for them to act, or maybe possibly set up is there a specific task force for organ harvesting and organ trafficking? Does that exist at this point?
So I think Secretary Kennedy had mentioned a little bit about looking into HHS and Health and Human Services as far as how that organ donation process works. I don't really know what he was referencing. I think it was more at a high level that he was trying to let the American public know that that was something he was looking into. And I was very excited to hear that he was looking into that, because that is something that we need more eyes on. I think it's regulated to a certain extent, but I don't think many people are aware of what those regulations look like, what the parameters look like. And so what the American people do is just be very aware that this danger exists, that this threat exists. If you wish to be an organ donor, my suggestion is to make sure you have a healthcare directive, make sure you have a patient advocate that is aware of your desires, so that if you decide that at the end of your life that you would wish to donate your organs, you know, then that's decided then. But what parents can do, what community members can do, is that they can educate themselves on all of these matters: sex trafficking, labor trafficking, what does it look like, what isn't it, what does grooming look like, what does sextortion look like, and really start to understand, because it's something that's not going away. And so the longer you put your head in the sand about this issue, the longer it's going to continue. But also, the more risk you're putting yourself and your family at, because you're not aware of what it looks like. So people need to become aware of what it looks like. Quick story, in Dallas, we were working with a nonprofit out of Dallas called Shepherd's Watch Foundation. They took us on a ride-along, and they focus most of their work on illicit massage parlors. And so we had done some undercover work with them in illicit massage parlors, and they do work closely with their local law enforcement. So again, it's nothing that they're taking on upon themselves. They have very close communication and contact with their local law enforcement, but understanding that these illicit massage parlors are in your community, my community, one of the ones we walked into, the illicit massage parlor, it was very evident because of the people that came out, what they were dressed in. My business partner, who is a male, had gone in first, and then 30 seconds later, I went in, and the reaction as soon as me, a female, walked in was completely different. They were shoving us out the door, but prior to that, they were, you know, trying to pull him into the back room. And so understanding that these circumstances exist in your community, my community, this one specifically was right next to a driver's ed school, where before we walked in, we saw a mother and her son walking right next door to a driver's ed school. And so thinking that it's happening in some more run-down city and not in a community like yours and mine is allowing them to operate in an area where people are none the wiser.
You know, adding on to that, we did the same. I did the same thing in a suburb of Las Vegas. It was my photographer, male, and myself. And it was tipped off, or, you know, I think it was something that I saw on Craigslist that looked suspicious. So we just said, let's just go in undercover and see. And that day ended with three people arrested, and it was gang operated. It was a massage parlor in a strip mall area, and it was sex trafficking operating out of this massage parlor. And it was next to these everyday, family homes, strip mall. And I just couldn't believe a few hours of effort, seeing something on Craigslist, thinking, that's odd, let's go check it out and, you know, lace ourselves with hidden cameras and so forth. I was assuming it would be a bust. And it was so shocking how easy it was to identify when we walked in the door, as you said, with your partner, what was actually going on. And that's what people don't realize, is it's everywhere and the predators are everywhere. And you don't want to put all the heaviness on people. You just want to know it'll get worse with AI technology, access to young people growing up on their phones. So you just want to be aware of it. So maybe you can prevent being in a situation where you're taken or you're trapped or you're unaware. I mean, awareness is key.
It absolutely is. And it's amazing that you mentioned that. I'm so glad that you and your partner did that, because it takes a lot of courage to do that. And you want to do it the right way. You did it the right way. So we're not obviously advocating for people to start kicking down doors and vigilante justice. But what you did was you did it the right way. You reported it to law enforcement, and then that was able to be effective in taking that down. But a lot of people realize or don't realize, you know, you make jokes about illicit massage parlors, but you don't realize that those women are forced into that.
They're forced.
Most of them are not allowed to be there or not allowed to leave of their own free will, and they don't want to be there. And so they're terrified. They're not allowed to leave. And what was even more, I guess, frustrating was one of the ones we walked into. There were two Johns that walked in right as we were walking in, and they were just normal, everyday guys wearing a t-shirt and a baseball cap. And that took everything in my power to not just be like, are you kidding me right now? Like, this is what you want, but you're going after someone that has no say? You're contributing to this slavery? Like, how disgusting. And they were, like I said, the average looking guys, the guy that could live next door to you, like that's what they looked like. And so it was really frustrating, but people need to be aware of what it looks like. They need to be aware of the threats online and how I'm able to sleep at night, as horrifying as everything is that I see, is that we were all gifted with something, a gift, a quality, a talent to be able to apply in certain fights like these. And I have children, And so I am doing everything in my power. My husband's doing everything in his power to ensure that we are leaving a better community for our children than that, you know, that what we lived in. And so I'm just one person. I'm just a mom. But what we want to...
You are more than that, Allie Hopper. You are far more than that.
Well, that's how I started out. And so trying to empower these women and these men, like, you know, I'm just a paralegal that lived in Florida that decided to enact legislation and look at where I am now. It is a reality that every single one of the people that are listening, that are in your circle, that my circle, that we can start a ripple, and that ripple just grows, and we have no idea of the lives that we're impacting. But if each one of us did something small, that is, like you said, a drop in the bucket, but eventually that bucket fills.
How do people get involved with your organization, what you're doing, and if not yours, just in their own communities?
Exactly. That's a great question. So we have a couple of resources on our website, guardagainsttrafficking.org. But as we're building out more resources that parents, community members, law enforcement, and lawmakers can use, there are two great organizations that we work with. The Association for the Recovery of Children, they have a very intense anti-human trafficking course, but Shared Hope International, they have a course, a number of courses that people can take online in their own home and start to educate themselves on what it looks like. And if there's interest, to become an ambassador in your community, that if there's a need in your community, Shared Hope will reach out and say, hey, you live in Dallas, Texas, we have someone that is in need of a training or an education. And so they activate the ambassador in the area of which a request is being made. And that is how you start that ripple effect. But it starts with education. It starts with being able to not only educate ourselves, but educate our children and start to empower them in ways. And our vision is, I mean, you remember the DARE program, right?
Yes, of course.
Our vision, it was impactful.
It was
to create a program almost like that so that it's age appropriate, but you start at that age where even now, you know, as a mom and married, I still remember that DARE program. You still remember that DARE program.
Because they showed up in our schools.
Yep. And so making sure that it's age appropriate. And so, you know, you question, how can you talk about such a heavy topic in an age appropriate way? Well, DARE did it. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're talking about drug use. They're talking about things that if you get really dug into the weeds on it, would not be age appropriate for the children in which you're communicating, but you're starting a conversation in a positive way that leaves a lasting impression. And to be able to leave lessons like, if you're on fire, stop, drop, and roll. Three words that everyone knows. So if you see something, say something. If you feel that something is wrong, contact law enforcement. It is their job to investigate. It is not your job. You don't have to investigate to be certain that something is wrong. But if you feel like something is wrong, say something and call someone and report it and allow them the ability to investigate. And that's where the American public can start doing things, is becoming aware and becoming watchdogs in their own communities so that traffickers know, oh, hey, I know, you know, this area in Florida, like Sheriff Grady Judd, he's done a great job combating, you know, the sex trafficking issue. And so a lot of the sex traffickers themselves have stayed outside of Sheriff Grady Judd's bubble because they know that their law enforcement has a zero tolerance policy for that crime. So we need that replicated throughout every single city, every single state across the country, that we have a zero tolerance policy for sex trafficking. We have a zero tolerance policy for labor trafficking, and we have a zero tolerance policy for harm against children.
Well, I hope your organization continues to get the attention, the funding, whatever it needs to continue to do what you do, because you're before legislators, and that's impacting from the top down to the bottom. There's little things we can do individually, but the lawmakers have to make some major changes. It seems like the new administration is being aggressive, which they are. It's a little by little we're getting more progress along the way. Please come back and join me on Killer Jeans at any time. This was so informational. And I don't think it's too much for my listeners and my viewers. I think it's information that needs to be out there. People need to be aware of it. And because it's also trickling into other genres of wealth. You know, we didn't really go into that, but there's a lot of tiers of this trafficking at these wealthier levels, such as Dubai, which we're hearing a lot about, and all these other countries of great wealth that are getting these influencers and models to come across the world, and they are sex slaves, and they don't realize what they're walking into. And you see different tiers of it, from the border to the high-level operation with the amount of money behind it. It's frightening, and I think a lot of girls, any young girl, is susceptible and vulnerable if she's not aware of what's going on. And awareness is key. Talking about it is key. Hearing the horrifying stories and the reality of it, it's key, because it shakes you to your core, and then you're on alert. You're aware of it, you know? Thank you for being here. Any final thoughts before we let you go? Thank you for all of the, hour-plus time you spent with us.
No, absolutely. And thank you so much, Melissa, for having the courage and bravery to dive into this subject. It really needs to be discussed, and I just really appreciate you for having me on. What I would say is that we hear the common names like Epstein and Diddy, and we hear about the crimes that they did, but those are the highest level crimes because of their recognition, their name recognition. Those are just templates for what is happening across the country. Those types of parties, those types of services that were given out, those types of victims, they are given out in smaller forms. Like those rings exist across your community and my community. And this administration has worked very hard to break down and raid these trafficking rings. But we as the American public need to be very much aware, coordinate very closely with our law enforcement, be very aware of what our children are doing, and be very aware of who they're interacting with as much as we are. But I would encourage your listeners to take that first step by starting to dig into some of the training, starting to understand some of the signs, and really not be afraid. Be courageous in if you feel something is wrong, say something, because that could save somebody's life.
And thank you for everything you do, literally saving lives and bringing all of this information to us and to the top. So we appreciate what you do.
Thank you so much, Melissa.